It's Thursday. I'm Gab. He's Jules. And hey, guess what, Jules? I'm back. You missed me, didn't you?
Of course.
We got a very packed show for you because we'll be talking about Project Big Picture, all the excitement, some nations league, Cristiano Ronaldo testing positive.
Yeah.
But I think there's one place to start, and it's with Mark Ogden. Welcome, Mark. Let's get right into this Project Big Picture thing. Let's not go and recap everything because I think, you know, most people, unless you've been living under a rock, know what's happened. But can you just run us through a little bit the timeline here? Because, you know, we like to believe that the Big Six had been meeting regularly about the situation in the Premier League. They met on Thursday. On Sunday, these plans get leaked, and it emerges because the PR guy that Liverpool and Manchester United hired to represent them tells us that, hey, Liverpool and Manchester United, in the form of John W. Henry and Joel Glazer, are the ones driving this. It comes to a vote on Wednesday. All 20 clubs vote unanimously not to pursue it. I'm interested, the other four members of the Big Six, did they just get cold feet all of a sudden?
Well, like I said, last Thursday there was a meeting, and The Big Six talk a lot. This has been going on for months. This predates the lockdown and the pandemic, but they had a meeting last Thursday in which they discussed the ideas. Liverpool and Man United fronted it, and that meeting was to get the Big Six on board. That they also have the document as the outline of the plans, a radical plan, and I'm told that people at United and Liverpool didn't expect it to be accepted straight away. They needed a bit of work on it, needed areas that needed to be finessed, shall we say. Some clubs weren't in favour of the £20 cap on away fans, for instance, so there were issues to work through. But it came at the weekend, and then all hell broke loose, as we know. But I'm told that with the situation now whereby all 20 clubs have voted to work on another plan, another proposal to change the format of the Premier League, that United and Liverpool feel they've been vindicated by their approach, that they've got something on the table that wasn't there in the first place.
Okay, I still feel, strategically, somebody leaked the plan to the Sunday Telegraph, right?
It can't be Liverpool or Manchester United. This would be okay. So counterproductive, right?
So at that point, the other people who had access to it were the other four clubs in the Big Six. And this, to me, seems like a massive strategic misstep by Liverpool and Manchester United. Because if you can't trust the other four clubs who most obviously stand to benefit from it,
yeah.
Because it had to be one of those four who leaked it, or, you know, or unless it was Rick Perry. I mean, if they had gone in with a unified voice, all six clubs, Mark, on Wednesday, would there have been a different outcome?
No, I don't think there would, because the Premier League voting rights mean that there has to be a 14-6 majority for any big decisions to pass. Now, the other 14 teams, you know, football's flyover states, if you want to call them that, they were never, ever going to vote for this. The Big Six would want it. The 72 EFL clubs, by and large, would want it. But the 14 clubs that don't really get anything out of it in the Premier League hold all the sway. They actually hold the power, bizarrely. There's always this complaint that the Big Six control everything in the Premier League. On this occasion, it's the lesser 14 that have controlled it, because they have nothing to gain from this. That the drawbridge is taken up by the Big Six. So it's the likes of Newcastle and Leeds and Aston Villa, big clubs that have got a great past and a promising future, would never be able to close the gap on the Big Six. But they have no desire to, you know, make the EFL strong, because they don't think they want to be in it. So they voted it down because there's nothing in it for them.
Jules, I kind of think, though, that if the Big Six had come with a big club, with a proper PR thing, with an argument saying, look, we're helping all the little clubs in League One and League Two, with the FA on board, here's 100 million. Oh, wait, is that not enough to convince you? Here's 150 million, you know, which incidentally, that 100 million gift, that's basically a bribe, yeah? I mean,
yeah.
Like, okay, all right, just so we're clear on this, right? Then they might have had at least a shot at winning the PR battle. Now, they don't, and they look stupid, and they looked greedy. At least the two clubs, or not even the two clubs, because we shouldn't talk about clubs. We should talk about owners. We should talk about Henry and Glazer, because and Mike Gordon, to a lesser degree. These are the people who went out on a limb. It's not the clubs, right?
Yeah, but you can see, I think the need for a reform of the Premier League and the whole English football pyramid is needed. So, I can see why they've tried to work on it and tried to find a way. This was never going to work, give all the power to the top six club. I think what is worse is they try to tell you, yeah, but it's actually not six, it's nine, because we can incorporate three who've been the longest in the Premier League. But of those nines, we just need six you know, we need six out of the nine to pass everything we want to, so basically go back to the top six can decide. So that, but I like the fact that the conversation is still open, because I think they know there's a need for...
There are some very good points in the plan.
And there are some really good stuff in this plan. Others I'm not so convinced with, but there's certainly some good, there's some positive stuff in it. So don't throw it all in the bin. But you will certainly have to review the sort of big six dominance and the fact that they can decide everything they want, even vetoing, like if you want to buy a club, Gab, they can say, we don't fancy you coming here.
Right. So you could say the Premier League,
outrageous, really.
Premier League essentially did that already with Newcastle United. But Mark, I just want to get a sense from you on the back of that, because this wasn't super clear to me, right? So they guaranteed 25% of the rights of the broadcast income and to the EFL, but then equally, because of this voting rights business, where six of the nine they could make the long-term decisions, who's to say that in a couple of years they don't make the long-term decision to just go to reduce it from 25% to 10%?
Of course they can.
And my other question is, if they knew and they knew that the FA has a golden share and could have vetoed everything, why push on with this when you know the FA can veto it?
I think it was a strategic move just to try and get a discussion on the table, because the Premier League has been in place since 1992, but it hasn't really changed much since then. And, you know, back in 92, when the whole document was brought out for the Premier League, it was meant to be an 18-team league. So this idea of making an 18-team league now is not that radical. It's something that's always been there. So I think the big clubs want changes that have never taken place. So from United and Liverpool's perspective, and I've been told that, believe me, that they will not care about the negative publicity. They just don't care. The owners don't care. The clubs don't care because they're used to it. I think that what they've got out of this is the chance to reshape the Premier League to their liking, but they'll have to accept that it has to be to the liking of the others as well as them. They can't just, you know, drive a whole combined harvester through it and expect it all to go their way.
All right, podcast listeners, you're still with us. We said goodbye to our TV viewers. Augie, I think all three of us are in agreement that there were some good things in the proposals, and as you yourself, and I agree with you, Augie, you know, there are things that I think need to be looked at. And again, Liverpool and United are spinning it as, oh, if we hadn't done this, then they'd never looked at them. No, I think they probably would have regardless. So let's talk about some of those things that we like. We're going to mention something that we like.
Okay. That you would keep from the plan.
Yes. I, straight off the bat, 18-team Premier League, boom, done. I'd go even further. I'd make it a 16-team Premier League, but I may be too radical there.
Why? Why would you like? I mean, it's like in the Bundesliga in France.
Yeah.
A lot of the top clubs especially would like to go down to 18 as well.
I think there's far too much strain on players. I mean, later on we'll be talking about the effects of travel and COVID and all this jazz. I absolutely hate midweek league football. I don't think it should happen ever.
Why?
It's not fan friendly. It's not TV friendly. There's no reason for it. And you get a lot of less relevant games. So the Premier League's idea of having an 18-team top flight, of course, when they had the 18-team top flight back in 1992, they famously later went up to 22 teams.
Yeah.
So that's my one. Let's have an 18-team top flight. Let's have fewer games, more meaningful games. Let's have players who are actually rested and able to perform, who don't drag themselves all around the pitch. Augie, what do you? Anything else? Anything you like?
Yeah, I agree with the 18-team thing, but the only danger of that is I just wonder whether that would be a way for the bigger clubs to open the door to more games in the Champions League. So you're getting more midweek football there, and Champions League is great, but you know, next week we have teams like Krasnodar and Rennes that are playing, and
let's be honest.
All right,
what's wrong with Rennes?
Sorry, Jules, but
Augie, sorry. Just to make it clear, you just dissed Krasnodar and Rennes, yeah?
Yeah.
And...
Yeah.
So you play Man of the People with Bury and Rochdale and Macclesfield, but Krasnodar and Rennes.
Yeah. That's really who he is. That is really who he is, I think.
Seriously, man.
The third best teams in France and Russia last season. Look, the idea, what I'm saying is that, but if you improve the Premier League, you don't want to, as a knock-on effect, diminish the quality of the Champions League. And that is an area of concern that I'd have, that the increase of free midweeks would lend itself to more European football, or God forbid, more international football, which is the last thing we want. So I do think that the 18 team thing is a good thing. I do like the idea of giving greater monies to the lower leagues. I know you don't, Gab, but you know, I'm more Robin Hood than you. I think I'd rather give them a bit more money. But yeah, and the proposal for fans as well, £20 for away tickets. You know, it works in Germany.
That's a good one. Yeah,
Some of the prices in England are absolutely disgraceful, so especially in London for away fans, that they're absolutely off the scale. And I think one thing we've found during the pandemic is that football really, really needs fans inside stadiums. It's just such a soulless exercise without fans. So I'd make it even cheaper than £20. I'd make it 15, 10 even, just to get the grounds full, because football needs supporters.
I don't think filling Premier League grounds has been a problem thus far. Augie, give me something. So that's your one that you like, the £20 for away. What do you like?
Parachute payments.
They getting rid of them.
Wind me up so much. So you're in the Premier League. You're not good enough for the Premier League because you're coming back down to the Championship, and yet you leave with a huge amount of money that makes it so unfair when you go back to the Championship compared to the other teams who obviously didn't have that kind of revenue.
So
why?
So the argument for parachute payments has long been, and I think it's, in the real world, it's a foolish argument. The argument has long been, well, we need the parachute payments because otherwise, when I go down to the Championship, I lose $80 million in revenue and I can't afford to pay my players because all of a sudden I have a huge shortfall in revenue, hence the parachute payments. There's a very good solution for that.
Yeah.
Just put it in the standard Premier League contract. If you get relegated, And I do this for everybody. I do it for Man City and Liverpool too. You know, hey, Trent Alexander-Arnold, you're going to make 140 grand a week, but if Liverpool get relegated, you take a automatic 50%
pay cut.
But
there's a lot of clubs who do that already. Every club in the rest of Europe do it without parachute payments.
And a lot of clubs in the Premier League do it, but many don't. And I agree with you on the parachute payments.
But my issue is then some of the clubs who have those clauses in players' contract or, you know, we're going to cut your wages in half if we go down. They go down, they still get the parachute payments. So the whole argument of we need parachute payments, this is like, no, because they win-win in both situations. So I would scrap the parachute payment, and that's a really good point that I like from the big picture project.
And Jules, just on that, the strange thing about the parachute payments is if you look at the clubs that have been relegated from the Premier League in the last 10 years, the vast majority haven't come back despite having the parachute payments. So it's not as if it helps them come back. It actually makes things worse. It almost lends itself to laziness and carelessness when they're in the Premier League because they know this money's coming. All we ever hear with the playoffs is it's the richest game in world football. It's worth £200 million because clubs are already realising that if they get promoted and don't even win a game the following season, it will be worth £200 million because they'll get relegated with a big fat cheque. But it still doesn't seem to help them bounce back. I mean, look at Huddersfield. Look at teams like, I mean, Sheffield Wednesday have been down at the third tier. All these, Bradford, all these clubs that have had parachute payments have completely waited. Sunderland, a club as big as Sunderland, with a parachute payment should have come back straight away. But mismanagement at all these clubs has let themselves squander this parachute payment. So it doesn't actually help them in the first place.
Yeah, you mentioned it there, mismanagement. And to me, this is the thing that rankles. I like the fact that, I mean, again, they didn't go into detail because, as you said earlier, it is more of a working paper. But I like the fact that they're talking about issues of salary caps, of some version of financial fair play. They've already brought in some instances before. I think more broadly, there's 20 professional clubs in the Premier League. There's 72 in the Football League. Correct me if I'm wrong, because I know you watch more football at that level than I do, but I believe the next tier down, the conference or whatever the hell it's called now, is effectively fully professional, right? And the next tier down
pretty
from
much,
that, most of the players are professional as well, right? So I don't think we need a system, if it's not going to be self-sustaining, where you can go 5 or 6 tiers down and people are playing professional football. Like, if you can do it on your own, that's fine.
But they must have the money to do that, right?
Well, otherwise, but they have the money because they have trickle down and they have, sometimes you have owners who put the money in. But this is my issue, right? I can see the argument from, I'm going to turn into a glazer for a second here, picture it. I can see the argument where I'm Manchester United, I'm generating all this money, and I'm giving money to Macclesfield or Rochdale. I just keep picking Rochdale because it's near you, Mark. So that you can go and spend money on wages and pay people more than you can afford. That is my issue.
But surely, even for the top flight in England, having strong lower leagues is important, right?
Why?
Well, look at how many players in the England squad came from the lower leagues.
In the game against Wales, the starting 11 for England had played more in the lower league than in the Premier League. The 11 that started that game.
Right, because you're counting.
It doesn't matter. It's still the truth.
Sorry.
I'm going to tell you what
we're talking League Two and Conference here, yeah? And secondly,
Championship and League One is the same. Because in your academy, in your United Academy, Mr. Glazer, because you're Mr. Glazer, okay. In your academy, 99% of your kids are going to be released, right? One is going to make it at United, maybe two, maybe five are going to make it in the Premier League. The rest are going to make it in the Championship, League One and League
That's
Two.
Fine.
So just for the kids that you've had in your academy since the age of five, you would want them, just for them, to have a decent life as a football player, even if it's in the fifth league or the sixth division, and have a decent, you know.
I don't want the no. I'm sorry.
So you want them to be released and then do nothing and then be on benefits or be unemployed or do like a.
First of all, that's the government's job to deal with people who are unemployed and on benefits. I don't want them. That's not Malcolm Glazer here. That's not Joel Glazer and Avram Glazer's job. But my point is, I think there is tremendous value in the pyramid. There's tremendous value in grassroots football as a community hub. I think these clubs are very, very important. I want to see, if they're going to get money, I want to see those clubs, that money spent on facilities.
But you
I don't want it spent on wages for people if you can't justify it.
But you need
I'm sorry, it's not a giant welfare state.
But you need a good team for your community to, you know, to want to go to see the stadium.
It's complete nonsense. You don't need a good team for you. You need a team that's solvent.
If Rochdale lose 10-0 every week because they don't have money to pay decent wages to good players, Mark and his family are not going to go and watch Rochdale after three games because they've conceded 30 goals already in the season.
Mark, can we knock this idea on the head, please? I'm curious to get your opinion here, because this is something that people break up and say, oh, unless the football's good, people aren't going to go. People go to football in the lower leagues and have done forever when it was good and when it was bad. They go there because this is their team, it's their sense of community, it's their day out. They don't go to Rochdale because they think, oh, if we're really good, we'll get promoted to the Premier League one day. Am I wrong here?
No, but...
Are they going to stop going if the players are 10% worse? Or the players won't even be 10% worse. They'd just be 10% less paid.
My teenage son's a Rochdale fan, and he has this naive belief that Rochdale can make it to the Premier League, but they can't, obviously.
Of course.
But you're right. Listen, I mean,
he said
City were in the Man City were in the third division maybe 20 years ago, and the fan they had 30,000 turn up every week because the football was rubbish, but the fans would turn up because that's their thing, and no matter how bad they are, they would turn up. But I think there's just two things I want to pick you up on, Gab. First of all, you can't just say to the lower leagues, you can't be pro. You can't deny people the ambition to go higher.
No, I'm not denying the ambition. You can be pro. You can do whatever you want. You can get a whole freaking, like, you can get 20 cryogenic chambers like the kind Cristiano has at home that cost £2 million each. You can do all that. But if we give you money, if we subsidize you, you're going to use the money on training facilities, on youth development, and on stadiums. You're not simply going to blow it in wages or use it to pay your director's salaries.
But there are a lot of clubs in the lower leagues that have spent money on the grounds. They've got a lot of new grounds in the lower leagues. Certainly since the Taylor report in 1990, there have been a lot of new grounds, ground improvements. Many of the grounds in League One and League Two would be, you know, up there with the best in those divisions in Germany, Italy and Spain. There's some great facilities out there, so they haven't wasted it on player wages. I think as well what you have to realise is that, you know, since the Premier League started in 1992, 49 of the 92 clubs have played in the Premier League. So that's not just the 20 that are there now. More than half of the Football League, 92 Premier, have played in the Premier League. So you have to keep that pathway open and give these clubs the opportunity to do that, because a lot of these clubs are well run. They've got good stadiums, modern facilities, good academies. You know, there's teams in the lower leagues with academy, you know, Salford, who, you know, but they have an academy which is producing players for the team. So all these clubs are doing it properly. There's very few that are putting money in and just spending it on wages. And the clubs that do that, like the likes of Bury, that paid way beyond their means to get promoted, you know, there was a day of reckoning, and they were expelled from the league because they couldn't pay the bills. Well, so as long as there's proper governance there to do that, then I think we should give these clubs the opportunity to thrive and progress.
I think you hit the nail on the head with proper governance, and I think we can all agree on that. And this is another thing that really bugs me about these clubs, because I raised the issue, I bumped into Greg Clark years ago, and I said, dude, you don't have proper governance in the Football League. You have a freaking zoo, right? Why can't they deal with it? And he said, the problem is we've asked them for proper governance and oversight, and every time the clubs vote against it. The clubs want to be able to the owners want to be able to sell and get out to sell whoever they want to so they can come in and out. The clubs don't want it.
Yeah.
You know what I would say to them? Hey, you don't give yourself proper rules of oversight, of governance, of transparency, so that the fans, if the Barry fans had been there to see what their money was being spent on, if they knew, they would have been the first people there to hold their own club to account. Right? So if you want this money, when give yourself the rules. Sorry.
When Barry went, the year that when Barry went bust, the season prior to that, they were paying their top paid player £8,000 a week in League Two. It was crazy money. They couldn't afford it. And that is why they went bust, because they were paying stupid money. It's just, you know, if the business model doesn't work, these clubs should fail. We're not bankrolling bad clubs. We're bankrolling clubs at the minute because they are unable to raise money through the turnstiles because the government won't let them play football. But they will allow the former Arsenal manager to talk about his book in the Palladium with a full house in an inside venue.
Okay, whoa.
The salary cap is a good thing for League
Two. Hang on. Let's let Augie explain that, because not everybody might have caught that reference. Please explain, Augie, what you're referring to.
Yeah, Arsene Wenger has a book out, and earlier this week he's on a book tour, and in central London, the London Palladium, a big famous theatre, was open. He gave a speech about his book, and the Palladium was full. Very little social distancing, people wearing masks. But the point is, it was an indoor venue with a crowd, and that was deemed to be safe by the powers that be, whereas lower league football grounds, any football ground in England at a professional level, you can't get fans in, despite it being outdoor, a much bigger space. Great opportunity for social distancing. So the rules are ridiculous, and the Premier League are still pushing the government to allow fans in, because the culture secretary was speaking yesterday saying they are hoping that they can have socially distanced pantomimes at Christmas for kids.
But like, so the Premier League
again,
is not pushing
theaters.
Well, I don't know who's pushing from the Premier League, but they're doing a rubbish job. If they can't prove to anyone at the government, look, this is what happened at the Palladium, this is what happens in other venues as well. It was not just Arsene Wenger, but not in football. The gates at the stadium are still closed. Who is doing that rubbish job for the Premier League? Because they clearly need to be sacked and replaced by someone else who can actually put a plan together and show the government, look, this is how we can do it. We can bring 5,000 in a 60,000-seater stadium with no risk or anything. There's many entrances, there's many gates. The people will social distance, they will wear masks, they will... It's not that complicated. I'm sorry.
My conspiracy theory on this is that there's a big power play right now between the government and the Premier League. So the government will not unlock the doors to stadiums until the Premier League bail out the lower leagues, and the Premier League aren't going to bail out the lower leagues until they get the admission from the government that they can open the gates. And it's a power play. There's no reason for it, but the government said, "Well, we're not bailing you out." Oliver Dowden, the culture secretary, mentioned the other day the billion pound new transfer fees spent by the Premier League this summer. They're trying to make the point that the Premier League is spending money they don't have. So while they have that money to spend, let them spend it in the lower leagues. Until you do, we won't open the stadiums. And it's killing the game. But it's a political power play.
I love it when people like Oliver Dowden go and do the whole man of the people. Like, you know, I sometimes remember, I mean, he probably had a little, like, you know, I wonder, I don't want to delve into politics, but it is interesting how in these times of crisis, you know, sort of right or left, conservative or more laborite, like all these things kind of seem to dissipate and you just kind of go for consensus. Augie, thanks so much.
Thanks, Augie.
Cheers, guys.
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search. Match with Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/gab. Just go to Indeed.com/gab right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/gab. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. All right, big picture's dead, so let's leave it there. Huge news, Cristiano Ronaldo testing positive. We've had a whole, it feels like when they go off with their international teams, we have a whole rash of positive tests, which might actually make you a little bit suspicious about why there aren't quite as many with club teams. But Jules, this is massive for him.
This is massive for him. I think it's massive for the whole, you know, COVID case in football, really, because we've had big names players who had in Neymar, Ibrahimovic, plenty. But he certainly felt that hit everybody a bit more because he was Cristiano, and would have been the same for Messi, for example. And the thought that he would miss a few games, might even miss the game against Barcelona in week two of the Champions League, is big. And, you know, I think we saw it with Portugal, José Fonte, for example, who is one of Cristiano's, if not Cristiano's best friend in that Portugal squad, also got the virus before Cristiano, was tested positive before the France game last Sunday. And, you know, and had to go home. And then maybe that's the relation there. Maybe he's there. Well, but it's a huge...
What's difficult with Cristiano is that this is a guy who we know is so maniacal about his training, his nutrition. Yeah. He's so careful.
Yeah, Juve have a special... Not taking a risk, yeah.
Both Juventus and Portugal are ready, I would think, would just wrap him in cotton wool. Yeah, and he would want to, right?
Yeah.
And then, and look, it's unfortunate, and I'm not a social distancing expert, but I will say that the way it was received was not a good look. He tweets out or puts that picture on Instagram, that selfie of him eating with the entire Portugal team at that big long table. And, you know, it looks like they're all there. Now, it might be respecting the protocol, but I think visually people are going to look at this and say, well, wait a minute. How do we know that they haven't all infected each other? How do we know he didn't catch it from José Fonte, for example?
That's very true. I mean, there is this period of incubation, so you can't see José Fonte on the Monday. Well, you can, but it could also have been that he got the virus before leaving Italy and Turin, and, you know, and he just showed up on the test a week later, right, or something like that with Portugal.
Because it could be a longer period.
It could be a longer period of 14 days. And we saw Weston McKennie also testing positive. Adrien Rabiot was a contact case. So he missed out the first game with France too, because he had to self-isolate as well. So this is getting very complicated then, because you can't really trace when he got it, how. And I think that makes it even harder.
Cristiano's sister... Put a post out there on Instagram, which it's in Portuguese. I read it. I have some familiarity. I'm not going to try to interpret it, because some people read it as her suggesting.
She doesn't really believe that he's positive, right?
Either she doesn't believe he's positive, or she doesn't believe. That's how some people read it. I assume she was being sarcastic. I read the translations. There's conflicting ones, so I'm not going to go there. But I think in general, any message from Cristiano's entourage, other than what, for example, his partner Georgina sent, where, you know, said like, oh, get well soon, whatever, I don't think helps the matter. Anything that can lend itself to confusion or whatever. Long and short of it is he took a medical flight, which you can do if you're Cristiano Ronaldo, with permission from the authorities, from Portugal, back to Italy, which he was an ambulance, secure COVID ambulance came and picked him up.
Because he was supposed to self-isolate in Portugal.
Exactly. Right. He was supposed to self-isolate in Portugal for 14 days. Instead, he's in Italy where self-isolation is 10 days. If after 10 days he shows a positive test, then he can play again. He's obviously going to miss match day one of the Champions League. He could be back for the Barcelona game and that big showdown with Messi, which, you know. But who knows where we're going to be at that point. I mean, the one thing I wanted to drive home, though, is that we need to wrap our heads around the idea that this season, especially with winter approaching in Europe, everything's going to be different, right? You saw Ukraine, they had six or seven positive cases. We're not going to see the real line. It's like a rash of injury. We're going to have these weird situations crop up.
Yeah, we saw Genoa as well, for example.
Exactly. Now, the big case in Italy, also involving Juventus, was obviously when they were hosting Napoli. Napoli, in the end, didn't show up, and they had to forfeit the game, and they were given a 1-point penalty. Now, because this is Italy, they say they're going to appeal the decision. The appeals process could be endless, because we love our justice to be very slow and late. So we don't know the outcome of it. In a nutshell, though, what the initial findings found was that Napoli was, after the first positive cases, they were told by the local health authority, you should follow the government protocol. And then later they asked the health authority again, and the health authority said, no, you need to stay home. So what the Italian FA's disciplinary committee is saying is, well, when you asked them again, you had already decided you were staying home.
Yeah.
Which, I don't know how you prove it. Napoli are going to try to prove the opposite and say, no, look, we had everything booked. We had our flight ready. We had booked COVID tests for the morning of the game in Turin.
Yeah.
Again, without seeing the evidence.
Is it a bit harsh? Is it a bit harsh? Especially the one-point penalty. I get the forfeit, maybe. Yeah. 3-0, although, you know my opinion, I thought Juventus should have declared, like, okay, we're happy to postpone the game and play it. But the one-point penalty, surely that's harsh.
It feels a little harsh to me, unless they have some evidence that we don't know about. But I think one point that should be made is why these rules are in place and why they have to be like this is that there is no plan, at least not in Italy, as far as I know, in most European countries, for what to do if you have to stop down the season. So if you're going to get a whole bunch of games which are postponed, and by the way, this will happen because the minimum is what in most countries is what, 13 players, 14 players. If you start postponing games, you may not be able to finish the season. So I think what they should do right now, right this minute, figure out a system of playoffs or something that you can turn to if you're in this situation, if all of a sudden you have a rash of postponements. Much easier to resolve now than to resolve down the road. All right, Jules, let's delve into this a little bit further because we're already seeing it. I mean, in Serie A, I'm taking that as an example, there's 30 players who are now out after testing positive. And it'll probably... The number will probably grow up, will probably increase as they come back from internationals. It's a Milan derby on Saturday at 5 o'clock. Milan have two guys out. Zlatan looks like he's back, but, you know, unfortunately for Milan, they both play the same position. They're both center backs, Duarte and Gabbia. Inter, they're without Bastoni, Skriniar, Gagliardini, Nangolan, Radu, okay, whatever, get well soon, and Ashley Young. Now, when you've got these many players out for reasons that are not injuries, at what point, they have to play, fulfill the fixtures, whatever, at what point do we start thinking of putting asterisks on a season?
I mean, it's a very good point and a very good debate. In France, we started the season with, if you had more than four players, four or more, then you could postpone your game, which I think a lot of clubs agreed to at the beginning.
And you got rid of the French League Cup as well for this season, right?
Exactly.
To help free up some space.
Yeah, I mean, not just for the season, completely. Which I think clubs were happy to say, okay, four, because if you have more than four, let's say you have your four best players, it really, you know, it's a huge blow for your team. It's not really the competition that you want to see.
No.
People don't want to see games where you don't have your best players playing.
But is it still four? No, because they changed it.
Yeah, it's changed because a lot of clubs as well were saying, hang on, I've got all my squads. It's not my problem if Marseille have four players down. I'm Saint-Etienne, I want to play that game, and yet they were forced to postpone it. So almost the opposite to the Juve-Napoli game, in a way.
So now you need to have a minimum of players, right?
Yes.
In line with the UEFA directives.
Yeah, exactly. And so it's a bit like everybody else. So if you have 15 in your squad, that's enough. You can play even if that means 15 without your big stars.
In the Premier League, I think it's 13.
Yes.
In UEFA competitions, it's 13. But, I mean, this becomes an issue because if you have an outbreak at a team, you know, if Liverpool's starting defense are all out and all of a sudden it's Nico Williams, Matip, I mean, at some point it's no longer Liverpool. It's no longer what is advertised. And yet they did this because everybody's terrified of postponing games.
Yeah.
And as I said earlier, they should come up with a plan now for what'll happen if too many games get postponed.
But could you do, you could not do a sort of NBA-style bubble because the season is too long, right? So you can't just have the players in the same place.
No, you can't do that. But what you can do, I think, and what they should do, is have a plan in place for, okay, if worse comes to worse, let's have different contingency plans. And look, if we have to step down, if we postpone too many games, if it gets to April, let's say, and we only have 4 weeks left or 6 weeks left in the season, then let's go to this plan. And this plan might be, for example, you know, if you have a 20 team league, divide it four groups of five, maybe based on league position at the time, use a freaking algorithm. I don't care how you do it. Put them in different cities, different bases, right? And then you can put them in a bubble.
Yeah.
Test them before they go in and whatever, and do the bubble under those circumstances. But I'll tell you what I don't want to see is us to get to that situation later and not have any kind of plan in place.
No, no. Also for the Champions League, that starts again next week. And this year, because of the congestion of the fixtures, you're going to play Champions League every week for the first 3 weeks, then there's international break, and then you finish the Champions League group stages in 3 weeks in a row again. Which means that if a player tests positive just before the start of the Champions League, for example, he could miss at least the first two games, maybe the first three games, and that could mess up your whole team's Champions League campaign. And it would be just crazy.
And that's why I think UEFA, maybe they do and they haven't, they're working on it.
Yeah.
I think what they're hoping is, let's just squeeze in the group stage as best we can and then look at having some sort of bubble contingency that we can turn to in the spring.
Yeah.
You know, like they had the tournament, obviously, in August. Just have a plan in place, because I do not want to get there where it's like, remember here in England with the null and void discussions and all this nonsense. Have a plan now. Listen, nobody wants this, but this is a reality that we have to deal with. And already we're not going to see the real teams out there. Like, we're living with it because it's our entertainment or whatever. But let's have a plan now and not later on. All right, Jules, enough negativity, enough doom and gloom, enough Ogden. How about some quick hits?
Let's go, Gav.
Harry Maguire manages to get booked twice in the space of half an hour. Reece James manages to get sent off after the final whistle. And England lose at home to Denmark. Jules, Maguire's having a rough time. Do you blame him, or do you blame the managers who keep playing him?
Gav, I don't know where to start. I mean, it was bad already with United against Spurs. I thought that was even worse with England on Wednesday night. I mean, what is going on? There's a point, the second yellow card, he tackles with his left foot, he's right-footed.
Even he was trying to pass it, maybe, I don't know.
But even that just defy all sort of logic of anything, and he's just, I think he needs a break, I think he needs to stop playing for a while, I think he just needs to refocus, re-energize, just have a break from football, just stop, do something else. Just do something else for a little bit. Don't play with United at the weekend against Newcastle. And certainly don't play with United against Chelsea and Arsenal, which are the next two Premier League games, because I think it could get worse.
Okay, but all right. I agree with you on Maguire, but should we be called... I know we all love Gary Southgate because he's fundamentally a very nice guy.
I don't.
You don't like him?
No.
So you're going to blame him as well for playing Maguire?
Yeah, I don't think... clearly you can see that Maguire lacks confidence, lacks form, lacks pretty much everything. Rhythm, match fitness, sharpness, everything. Why'd you play him? Why'd you play him in a game like this where already you were not good against Belgium, for example, and not that, even Maguire, and then you play him in a game like this again. I think he needs a break. I think everybody can see it, and I just hope he gets it for his own sake.
I will say this about Southgate, because we're seeing the same film that's unwound with every single previous England coach. Everybody jumps on the bandwagon. It's so great. It's love. He's so good. Whether this happened with Capello, happened with Hutch, and happened with Eriksen. And then all of a sudden, they turn on him and totally go the other way.
But it's deserved, Gab. Look at the last four games.
This was,
it's dreadful.
Not a good run.
Germany have to come from behind to snatch a 3-3 draw with Switzerland. Gab, the nightmare continues for Yogi Löw. It's just one win in his last five. What's going on?
A lot of bad defending went on. I mean, this game, by the way, was fantastic. Germany-Switzerland, both teams going for it. There were defensive mistakes. There were some tremendous bits of skill from Kai Havertz, from Timo Werner. It's a really, really tough spot for Yogi Löw. And hey, what can I say?
Is it just the players or is it the organization? Because on the ball, as you said, in possession, they were good. But the defensive transitions were terrible.
I don't think they should be playing a back three. No,
I don't think.
And by the way, how appropriate is it? Schadenfreude, German word. No such issues for the world champions who win 2-1 away to Croatia in a World Cup final rematch. Jules, all good for Deschamps, yeah?
Pretty much, Gab, yeah. When he's trying different things, different formation, different
Griezmann,
players.
Mbappe, great.
Griezmann as a number 10. I don't think that's his best position, but certainly it worked a bit better for him on Wednesday night against Croatia. He scored a good goal. We saw a wonderful second goal, Pogba, Ding, and Mbappe. There's still things to sort out and to work on, but certainly in terms of collective unity, in terms of the confidence, the momentum, it's all looking really good for them. So, let's just hope it continues. It finishes 1-1 between Italy and Holland, which I thought was a really good game. Gab, has Franck de Boer proven some doubters wrong? No, he hasn't. And why can't Chiro Immobile score for any other team than Lazio?
So yeah, Chiro Immobile missed two sitters, which could have changed the game. What was interesting was Franck de Boer, perhaps knowing what happened the first time these two teams played each other, he played a back five.
Yeah.
It was a proper back five. He packed the midfield, dominated Italy's midfield defensively. Italy played well for about 20 minutes and then slightly went off the boil. It worked. It doesn't look like the Holland that we're used to seeing, but, you know, he got the result. They're still in it. What more can you want?
I mean, some of the substitutions he made towards the end of the game were quite weird. I mean, I still think he's not a good manager, but
he's still Franck de Boer. By the way, shout out to Nicolò Barella. Tremendous, tremendous performance. Andrei Shevchenko and Ukraine upset Spain 1-0. Jules, just one goal in the last three games for Luis Enriquez and La Roja. Time to worry? And is Traore a good fit?
I think there's a lot of issues in that team. I think De Gea is a big issue. Again, I'm sorry, but you cannot win anything with a goalkeeper like him. It's a big mistake he made. I don't care what people say. It's a huge mistake to come out AWOL like he did and then concede that goal. I think it's a problem not to have a proper centre forward, and maybe Morata, if he starts playing well for Juventus, could be the answer, but it doesn't work.
Not a big Gerard Moreno guy.
I don't think Gerard Moreno is good enough. I like him, but I don't think he's good enough. I don't think Oyarzabal as a false number nine is the answer either. I don't think Rodrigo, who's maybe more false number nine even than a proper number nine, is the answer either. And I don't think that Adama Traore, as good as he was, fits the style of Spanish football. He's someone who plays on his own. Spain for all those years, and the philosophy is to play as a team, you know, and there's none of that with Traore. I mean, I like Adama a lot. I just don't think he fits in what Luis Enrique is trying to do. Oh, you change everything to fit Adama, but I think that would be a huge gamble.
I think he'll figure it out. Funny.
For example, he crossed the ball 10 times. For who? I mean, there's one header by Rodrigo, and that's it.
Sergio Ramos did play up front at the end.
But Lautaro Martinez and Joaquin Correa score for Argentina in the 2-1 win away in Bolivia, Gab. It's the first time in 4 years that a player not named Leo Messi score for Argentina in the World Cup qualifier.
Yeah, that's a bit of a Fugazi hokey stat there, isn't it? You know, considering that this round of World Cup qualifiers just started, the other one ended about, hey, guess what, 4 years ago.
Yeah.
You know, when you count it in games, it's, I think, what, 5 games or 7 games, something like that. And in between, there was a World Cup where somebody not named Lionel Messi scored in it, of course. But it is a bit of an eye-opener.
Yeah.
I don't know. So many people are down on Argentina. There's a good story by our former colleague, Rory Smith, about, like, the, you know, Argentina no longer producing players, no longer selling players in the same volumes as Europe. But I don't know. I think Lautaro, Messi, Correa, Aguero, when he returns, at least up front.
But they've always been like that. It's more defensively, you know? I thought the balance of the team wasn't great. I think there's a lack of creativity behind in midfield. You know, Rodrigo de Paul, Paredes didn't play well, I thought.
What this team means is more Papu Gomez.
Papu! Yeah, and it was, I mean, still a good win because in Bolivia, away.
At altitude.
Absolutely.
Neymar scores a hat-trick in Brazil's 4-2 away win against Peru. Jules, that's 64 goals now, and he has passed the original Ronaldo. He is now second all-time behind Ore Pelé. Mm-hmm. Pelé has 77 goals.
Yeah.
He's going to pass him, isn't he? And he's going to get to 100, yeah?
Yeah, he's 28, Gab, so if you think, you know, with no bad injury coming up or anything like that, he's got another 5 years to play at that level.
Probably. 36 international goals in 5 years, that's a lot.
To go to 100, Pelé will overtake him, no problem at all. 100 will be a bit more difficult, but I would not be past him either. I think he's an incredible talent. Listen, I think I like the way he dedicated the goals to Ronaldo. You know, he went with a 9 and then he even did the finger celebration. I like that a lot. There's a lot of respect between them too. He's an incredible player, and I think he's in great, great form.
I'm going to say this at the risk of sounding like an old school dinosaur. First of all, Ronaldo phenomenal, the original Ronaldo. He would probably be right at 100 goals if not for the injuries that he suffered.
Yeah, and okay, but Michel Platini would have more goals if
he's now with all the friendlies and stuff. We're talking different eras. Pelé had fewer friendlies to play in as well. So,
yeah.
But that said, I just wonder, it seems weird that when we're not going to remember Neymar in the same breath as we remember Pelé and Ronaldo Fenomeno, are we? If he was to retire tomorrow? Like, do you feel like he still needs to do something else for him to be part of that Brazil GOAT conversation?
You're right. I think there's always a but with him. It's like, oh, one incredible talent, but there's something missing. And he still has a few years, if he keeps playing like that at this level, where maybe he can bridge the gap a little bit with the others. If will he ever be in that conversation, I'm not sure. Bruno Fernandes has angrily hit out a report that there was a row, an altercation, massive row halftime in the Manchester United defeat against Spurs 10 days ago, something in the dressing room between him and Solskjaer. Gab, do you believe him?
Well, he was there and I wasn't, so you know, I tend to believe him. Look, he made the point that, you know, the story initially was about him getting into a row with Lindelof. Then it was about, you know, the players having a row together. Then it was a row with Solskjaer. He's like, all these stories, they're, you know, none of them are true. They're just aimed at destabilizing Solskjaer. He did give his version of events,
yeah.
Which, when you read between the lines, you know, is it a heated conversation? Is it a row? Because he said, like, I was substituted at halftime for technical reasons, which, by the way, when you're substitute, technical reasons, for those who don't get it, it means you were playing badly.
You're
yeah?
bad.
He thought somebody else was technically, i.e. more skillful, better than you in, you know, in that moment. And he says, and I wasn't happy about it. He wanted to stay on. And he voiced his displeasure to Solskjaer. I, to some degree, that's normal. I think it's very hard from the outside to know exactly what happened. I think what is encouraging, if you're a United fan, is Bruno Fernandes is towing the party line. Right now, he feels, I'm going to back Solskjaer. I'm not going to throw Solskjaer under the bus. I'm going to stick to the facts. I'm not going to create a problem for Solskjaer. Because, look, there's a big elephant in the room, and that big elephant is named Mauricio Pochettino, right?
yeah.
You know, at some point, if the screws continue to tighten, if the players turn, the club will be, you know, in that position again.
Yeah.
So I think it's significant that Bruno didn't go down that route.
Yeah, and very intelligent.
Arsene Wenger's massive brainstorming / book tour continues. In fact, Jules, I believe you spent some time with him recently. The FIFA technical director says we should scrap the Nations League and have the World Cup and Euros every 2 years. I guess they'd be alternating. You cool with that?
Not really, no. No, that's not one of his best ideas, I think. I'm not sure which ones are, but I think the Nations League is working well. It's working well for the smaller countries, if you want, who play against teams of their level. They improve. It's really good for them. I think it works for the big clubs, the big countries, the big teams. We've seen some really good games, I think, for Italy, for France, for Germany, for Spain, all of that, Portugal. I think, again, it really helps that they play teams of their level. It's making it competitive. I just think it's easy to understand, because one of his points was like, it's hard. No one really understands how it works, knows. And
yeah.
For me, it's pretty
I may be a little bit cynical, right? Who organizes the Nations League?
Yes.
UEFA,
exactly.
Right? And there's a FIFA versus UEFA. Thing, you know, I think the Nations League concept personally is a great concept. I thought a year ago was tremendous. Does it feel a bit weird this year because they're shoehorning three games in one break and COVID and whatever? Yeah, guess what? Everything feels weird.
Yeah.
The whole world is weird right now, Jules.
And please, no Euros every 2 years, no World Cup every 2 years. It's just like it works. Find a way it does.
Yeah.
Let's keep it up. And finally, San Marino keep their first ever clean sheet away from home, Gab. How big of a... I can't believe you make me ask this question. I can't believe. San Marino, for all the fans listening.
It's massive, man. Come on. Monte Titano, come on. And it was a huge, huge deal. A clean sheet away from home.
Against who?
They were playing Liechtenstein, admittedly. Okay, but still.
They all count.
All right, well done to my friends in San Marino, my brothers from another mother, you might say. So we got time for today. But Jules, shall we come back on Monday and do this all over again? Till then, stay safe, stay alert.